This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, indeed, this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And as we do every Friday at 9 o'clock, we're broadcasting with an interview, an in-depth interview with someone who helps us understand current circumstances and events. And given the events in the Middle East, we thought it was appropriate, useful, and helpful for us to call upon Miriam Hirschlag to help us understand what's in the mind of Israelis and how the events are beginning to shape attitudes and how people are coping and grasping and thinking about the future. She's a writer and editor and broadcaster based in Jerusalem, and she's the opinion and blogs editor for the Times of Israel. And she hosts the Promised podcast as well. Miriam was born in New Jersey in the United States, my state, but she moved to Israel after earning her bachelor's degree from Boston University. And she began as a radio reporter for the Voice of Israel's English service and as an anchor on Israeli television. And we spoke with Miriam some months ago to get a better sense of the political and social meaning of those massive protests over the quote-unquote judicial reform bill, and she helped us gain insights into what it meant and what it could mean for the future. And we really had hoped to check back with her as that national debate moved forward, but naturally something else has indeed come up. It seemed appropriate to check in with her yet again, but we now take our discussion to a very different space, unfortunately. And this is in the days after the Hamas-led terror attacks in southern Israel and the increasing likelihood of a ground attack on Gaza by the Israel Defense Force. We wanted to have Miriam help us understand where Israelis are in their minds about what has happened. Are they feeling let down by the military and the government? And did the government, for example, take its eye off the ball because of its internal political disputes? And has the national understanding about national safety and security, has that in fact been shattered? And aside from an absolutely understandable national grief and outrage over the deaths as a result of the terror attack, is there a different sense of it by Israelis toward Gaza and Palestinians generally? And is there any public outcry over the ongoing air campaign towards Gaza and the inevitable collateral death that may occur there? Miriam, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Brooks. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm just sort of overwhelmed by following news and reading and paying attention to what's happening. And you obviously are infinitely closer to the edge of the events. And so give us a sense of what the national feeling and the mood is. I'm not going to ask you about military maneuvers because neither of us are military experts, despite my service as a private in the National Guard years and years ago. I think it's more appropriate for you to help us understand where people are in their headspace.
So nothing can really describe the enormity of what has happened here. I am opening a random page of my morning newspaper and staring into the faces of 32 beautiful people, all of whom were slaughtered. And they represent a tiny percentage of the death toll here, which at this time has reached over 1,300 Israelis, men, women, children, elderly, babies, soldiers, police officers. This is an epic moment for Israel, and I believe for the Jewish people, I believe for the Muslim world as well, that will change the course of history, because nothing like this has ever happened. And the extent of trauma and sorrow and fear here is beyond anything we've experienced, along with the sense of dedication to defending Israel, to putting a stop to Hamas in Gaza and elsewhere. And we have become, from a disparate and quarrelsome nation a week ago, into an entirely unified public body, both inside in Israel and greatly throughout the Jewish world.
People always try to take things like this and give them a sense of scale, you know, put them on a, creating a measuring stick, in effect, how to understand what's transpired. And many commentators and observers speak of this as Israel's 9/11 moment, but at an order of magnitude higher, given the comparable number of casualties versus population. One of the things that, of course, happened in America during 9/11 was there was this extraordinary sense of national cohesion. America, like Israel, is a fairly querulous nation among itself. But over time, that attenuates that sense of cohesion. Other things become important and they thrust themselves into the public consciousness. How likely is this to last in Israel for a considerable period of time, or will the ongoing earlier fissures begin to reassert themselves? What do you think?
First of all, arguing and disagreeing doesn't necessarily mean we're not all on the same page. So in a big sense, for as long as there is a war underway, for as long as Israeli soldiers are risking their life, I think, you know, whatever disagreements we have, and they're always there, will be muted compared to, you know, the bigger sense that we are now in a phase of self-defense. There is not a lot of dispute among Israelis emotionally or even intellectually that this doesn't have existential implications. You know, 9/11, as traumatic and horrific as it was, very quickly emerged as something that, for that many people could easily say, you know, the U.S. wouldn't be destroyed by it. It would be harmed terribly. American lives were lost at great scale. But given the U.S.'s size and its, you know, its geopolitical power, there wasn't, I mean, people felt terrified. I'm not saying that terror, fear is not a logical emotion, but the real concept that the whole country could go under was disputable. In Israel, it's less disputable because once Iran joins in this, we really have a very, very terrifying situation on our hands. And that isn't a theoretical, you know, that's not entirely hypothetical. So I think I wouldn't want to cast, even now when people are starting to be, you know, express anger at the politicians for all the reasons we can discuss if you'd like, there's still an overarching sense that we are in this. And the way you see it here is the flood of contributions people are making to this effort on a personal level. We're not talking about, you know, what the government and what the army is doing to mobilize and get things to people where they need to be, get the soldiers. We're talking about people putting a WhatsApp out and saying, I have a car, I can drive you to your base. I have food. Does anyone have containers that I can put this food in to bring to the soldiers? We're starting to get really funny videos from the soldiers that are saying, that are holding up items that they got from, you know, these large shipments that are pouring into the staging areas where a lot of the soldiers are still waiting to get deployed. And they're getting things like that should have gone to civilians. So like there was, you know, there's a funny picture of soldiers holding up sanitary napkins intended for the people in the Gaza area, who include a lot of women, and, you know, saying maybe we don't need this kind of bandage. Or another funny picture of somebody holding up matzah that someone had sent, saying, we're in this for the duration, but we're really hoping it doesn't last quite until Passover. So that is like
that's,
the
that's
way.
That's a pretty bleak humor.
Oh, yeah, a lot of gallows humor. I mean, Israeli soldiers are truly some of the world's greatest soldiers, also some of the world's funniest. And so, you know, that's how we all process, I think perhaps maybe I'm just being a little myopic, but I do think that's a Jewish, particularly Jewish way of handling tragedy and handling trauma. But at all times right now, the horror of what was done to our beautiful people living lives, frankly, of goodness along the area of the Gaza envelope, what was done to those communities is so horrifying, and the horror stays even as we move through our daily lives. We call our kids, we keep it light, we may make jokes. It does not mean that all of us aren't, whenever we close our eyes, seeing the images that I imagine many of your listeners have also seen, or thinking of the images that we were, are now being described to us of what happened in communities like Be'eri, like Kfar Aza, where the entire community was slaughtered, house to house slaughtered, and with atrocities committed. How do you hold these two emotions? You know, humans are complex. And we have to get through. We have to a little bit of denial for parts of the day. Then we go and we cry. We break down. And it isn't actually, you asked about the scale and what do we compare this to? So there, that may have some value. Right now, I don't think we still know what the framing of this, the narrative has not yet been nailed down. A lot of Israelis, or, you know, people with a sense of Jewish history, compare this to the Kishinev massacre, which was a massacre in what is today Moldova of Jews in a very similar sense of brutality that also included rape. And, so in that, in the epic poem that our national poet Agnon wrote about, Bialik wrote about this, that event, he described the Jews as helpless, as sitting there watching, husbands watching their wives raped, wondering, you know, just being ineffective and anemic and weak and, you know, people without a sense that that is not at all what happened here. People fought. They fought like lions. They threw themselves on their children to protect them. Some of them managed to save their babies' lives, their children's lives. Stories are still being told. They're still being written. So that's where we're at right now.
And we're going to have to take a break. Station identification and commercial messages. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with Miriam Herzlag of The Times of Israel. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and today's guest, in light of circumstances in the Middle East, we thought it was most appropriate to go to Miriam Herzlag. She's journalist, resident in Israel, obviously, with the Times of Israel, and we were discussing comparatives. How does it feel now versus, at least emotionally, how people may have felt back in the early, very, very early 20th century at the time of a different massacre and a different pogrom in Moldova? And comparing that, of course, to 9/11 for the United States. Let me ask you to throw a different comparative. Has this changed the way Israelis, I know it's early days. I mean, you know, you're taking, because of what you do, you're taking a sort of a constant measuring, a dipstick of opinion. But has this changed the way Israelis think toward Palestinians, toward people in Gaza, toward Arabs more generally, toward Arabs within Israel? Is that an evolving narrative in many Israelis' minds, or is it just simply too early to tell?
Obviously, we'll know more as this goes on, but it, and I should say that we're talking about a conflict with those in the Gaza Strip. We're aware that there are many Palestinians in the West Bank who identify with Hamas, but at the moment, I'm speaking, you know, anything could change, but at the moment, we haven't seen an eruption coming from the West Bank. Or frankly, from within Israel, where we have many Palestinian Israelis who identify strongly with the cause of Palestinian nationalism. I think people probably are thinking, rethinking a lot and reconsidering. One thing are peace activists who made connections with people in Gaza and tried hard to, you know, show that there could be possibilities for cooperation and for mutual assistance. I did an in-depth report on a scientist who was among the many things he's doing, working on getting, you know, water technology and cooperated with people in the Gaza Strip to try and deliver a technology called WaterGen, which makes water out of air, an Israeli invention. And one of the women who was taken in as a hostage into Gaza is someone who's a peace activist, involved in a group called Women Wage Peace, and spent her time picking people who came in from the Gaza Strip, giving them rides when they needed to Israeli hospitals, in a beautiful organization that worked to bring Palestinians in need of hospital care into Israel proper. So I think, you know, it's very hard to hold the cruelty that happened together with the sense that there was any hope for peace. So hopes for peace, I think, are low. I think Israelis, as upset and enraged as we are, understand that the civilian casualties in the Gaza Strip are enormous. I'm sure there is a large portion of the Israeli public that doesn't have a great deal of sympathy for them, says, well, the thousands of young terrorist crusaders that came over the border were raised in families that shared their values. It wasn't just them. So there, I think, you know, probably is a strong wave of lack of empathy at this point, but we haven't seen the results. We now are getting reports of 1,200 people dead in Gaza, which I think even Israelis who aren't, you know, heartbroken over that are aware that that poses at the very least a problem for Israel's image. We are, unlike, you know, a terror organization, we answer to a higher standard, an international standard and an internal standard. So I think we'll be seeing some, very quickly, we'll be seeing some grave concern over how widespread these are. At the same time, we know the problem here, right? In Gaza, Hamas is woven throughout the Strip. They don't have bases that can be isolated and attacked. They work out of residential areas. One thing that Israel hasn't done in the past that it has now done is severely bomb the fancier areas. I don't know if people are aware, but the Strip is not all refugee camps. There are areas like Rial where people are living well, and many of them are the places where many of the elite of Gaza live, including commanders in Hamas. And so those places that were, you know, in the past maybe avoided were flattened, to use an awful word, really destroyed. So yeah, it's a complicated, I can't give you a single answer about where Israelis are on the map. My gut tells me that this kind of horror does not exactly contribute to any sentiment for compromise, and certainly not for territorial withdrawal.
The events that took place last week, it's already almost a week now, this, I think, has shattered, it seemed to me, to be a sense among Israelis that there was a kind of normality, there was a sense of a precarious but real peace and security in their day-to-day circumstances. Has this vanished? Has that, I'm struck by something I read the other day where someone said, and we know what we have to do when they come, as opposed to if they come. When is a pretty, pretty definitive way of saying this. Has that envelope of peace and security evaporated now, and a different universe is now in place?
People who lived along the border areas never had a full sense of security, far from it, including those who were slaughtered in Gaza, who for years have been saying, we are not adequately protected. We need all kinds of equipment and salaried security people who are here on the ground in order to protect us. They were right. They were ignored. That is the case as well, to a great extent, along the other borders along the northern border. So that sense of security in the center of the country has now basically aligned with those in the border. So you have people stocking up for food, but also checking the locks on their doors, because another big shift here has been where our fear is directed. So mostly people in the center of the country are concerned about the possibility of their homes being hit by a rocket. And for the most part, people have figured out what they do. We have a really great whistle warning system with sirens. That's what woke us all up at 6:30 in the morning on Saturday. So, you know, we sort of know the drill. We know what to do. But in the scenes that we're being told about, where not just told, we heard them in real life. This whole thing was documented through social media with people on their phones saying, they're banging on my door. I don't think I can hold this door closed. I'm sitting here with a kitchen knife. I don't know what to do. Send the army. The army didn't come. The army is our, you know, that's our safety. You know, it's what we tell our children. Right? Our children say, you know, are the bad people going to come for us too? And we say, no, honey, we have a strong army. Israel's a strong country. And parents today will continue saying that because they're good parents, but in their hearts, they're going to never forget that the army wasn't there for hours and hours. So the sense of security is shot. It comes, you know, trauma adds to trauma. So we have just marked 50 years since the Yom Kippur War, and the echoes are so eerily similar. There were warnings. The government ignored them. There were maneuvers. Obviously very different from what was happening, on the Egyptian and Syrian borders in 73. And yet all of it rings the same. And that's the time since 1948, 1973 was, you know, the moment where Israelis thought it was over. And today you have a million drones can come over the border, and the center and the borders are now the same. We're a very tiny country.
I'm not pausing because I don't know what to ask. I'm pausing because I'm not entirely sure how to respond to that. Because, I mean, the one thing that does cross my mind the moment you alluded to the 50th year cycle, Yom Kippur War, than this, I remember also that in the U.S. before 9/11's attack on the World Trade Center, there had been a previous attack, not very successful, on the same building. And to a considerable degree, the circumstances were, if not ignored, at least not paid much attention to. And I think those people who criticize need to be aware of the complexities of these things. We're going to take another quick break, and we shall be right back with the Deep Dive.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
We're speaking with Miriam Hirschlag of the Times of Israel, opinion and blog editor, and we're trying to get a sense of the feeling of people, not specifics of military actions, although one question that does linger, why did people, young people, think that they could have a rave party very close to what was, after all, a militarized frontier? Just minutes away from it, in fact, that sense of complacency, maybe it was abnormal, maybe it wasn't, but that obviously has changed now. Where are Israelis on that, the sense of the inviolability of its border?
Nobody's having rave parties or any parties at all. Look, Israelis have lived with and, you know, navigated around and through fear all the time. We are ranked as fairly quite high up in the national happiness index. And yet there's no family untouched by war and terror. So we're used to somehow living in this way. And so when we go to visit family in the South, or, you know, my whole synagogue actually was at Kibbutz Nir Am shortly after a large barrage of rockets came over the border, and we all kind of had a conversation and said, okay, well, we have the army. And there are there shelters? Yes, there are shelters, enough for everybody. Yes, enough for everybody. So we'll go. And that's what you do. You sort of, you make the best of it, and you don't, you know, and I'm not saying there aren't fearful people who've given up, who too traumatized. You know, I know there, Israel actually has a great deal of very hard won, tragically won, experience and expertise on the issue of trauma. But in general, you know, that's what we do. People go vacation in the Sinai desert where people or terror attacks have regularly happened. We also go shopping at Dizengoff Center, the site of one of the worst attacks during the Second Intifada. You know, everywhere we go, there are reminders of, you know, bloody events that happened. And so you kind of work around it. At this moment, you know, people, I think, you know, right now, obviously nobody's running to have a party in the South, because they're scared and terrified and sad. But I think you will see Israelis are almost sort of by, they're almost, their our internal composition is one that has us going, pushing the boundaries, pushing the limits, and feeling very confident. And I'm hoping that will snap back, not in the next half a year, but, you know, in a year from now. It will require the government and the army to convince Israelis that they have understood what happened and that there's been a paradigmatic change in how they view security threats, because they did not foresee this. It was a complete surprise.
I occasionally look at your newspaper and the opinion pieces in it. Unfortunately, I don't, at this point, I don't have time to read everything I want to read.
You should always make time to read the Times of Israel. And I will say, the opinion section is great. I think I'm doing a good job. My colleagues in the news are doing an enormously brilliant job covering this with calmness, indefatigably, and getting it right, fixing it when it's wrong. And we're battling attacks on our site by, you know, we just got this morning a pop-up. Everyone saw it, as if it was a breaking news story that the chief of staff had declared that this war was unwinnable. So we're really, really in, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to praise, speaking objectively, I want to say that the Times of Israel is one of the main places where I think you can get a really good picture of what's happening here.
Self-promotion is an important virtue. What I was going to say was I was struck in particular by a column, an opinion piece that was published, I think it was 2 days ago, Hussein Abu Bakr article, which talked about the ways in which Hamas has positioned itself both internationally and then within its own community as, how shall I say it, the avatar of the larger resistance, the bigger resistance to Israel and the West, as a kind of millenarian struggle, or even, I'm going to use one of those words, an eschatological one of good or the future versus evil and the present. I'm sure that column received a fair amount of response from readers, both agreeing with it and probably things you couldn't print. But is that kind of sense about Hamas? Do you think his column nailed it? Do you think his column pointed the way to understanding?
We're hearing voices from Hussein Abu Bakr, but also other moderate Muslim voices who are feeling called. This has been his issue for many years, but even new voices that are bravely saying, this Islam is not my Islam, and trying to draw a very, very thick, clear line around what Hamas's death cult philosophy is, and its absolute distortion of what they perceive to be the beautiful aspects of Islam. It really, really is. And the lumping together by clueless supporters of the Palestinian cause who think that, you know, that Hamas is a legitimate representative and has legitimate political goals and, you know, and is fighting for the defense and the safety of Palestinians. Those disingenuous or simply, you know, stupid people who supported Hamas as if it was a freedom movement and not as if it was a death cult bent on killing Jews everywhere, based on the lie that Israel was somehow harming the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, those people, I, you know, think, well, if they stick to their positions after this, then there's no hope for them. But what this is doing is opening a space for thoughtful, nuanced people who may have no love for Israel, who may see Israel's policies and actions in the occupied territories, they may consider them war crimes, and yet at the same time are able to say, no, this isn't my Islam. My Islam sees humans as the creation of God, or Allah, and, you know, and what they've brought upon their own people, forget about, you know, putting aside the horror of what they committed, against Jews, but what they've brought upon their own people is devastation and only devastation.
Given what you've just said, and there's a bit in your comment where you talked about, I forget the exact phrase you use, people who foolishly embrace Hamas as the representative of a just cause. You said it differently. There was something in there. Certainly in recent days, there have been all manner of demonstrations, pretty ugly ones, actually, cities in the U.S. and in parts of Europe and in Britain, which have in effect thrown their arms around Hamas as the legitimate representative and allied that to a cause that says there is no reason for anybody to support the Israelis in their time of difficulty, and that any words of consolation are misplaced at best. And the argument that some people are making, various columnists, people like Bret Stephens, I'm sure you've seen his comments on this, that such people are ridiculously deluded in the way in which they have perceived both the current circumstances and the broader issues. Do these demonstrations disturb or upset or confound Israelis, or are they simply just saying that's just the way things are?
So, look, we live in a world where a single image is very powerful, and 10 people doing something horrible, you know, take over the media. So I would be cautious, you know, those images, I saw them, the one that's, you know, seared into my eyeballs is the image of this boohoo act, this sort of boohoo gesture, like, oh, poor you, kind of, you know, why would you think I care? When the implication being, you know, we saw Palestinian children, you know, indiscriminately killed, and here you are complaining in the early one when our number was a death toll was 700. They were waving the number 700. It's odious, right? It's also sort of part of a dramatized way of responding pretty much knee-jerk to anything that happens. When you see the world as there's only the possibility of victim and oppressor, when you see Israel only as some sort of colonial, you know, project and not in any way a real place with real people who have authentic, you know, reasons to be in Israel, both because of the Holocaust, but deeply because, you know, Israel is part of, you know, is the Jewish home. You know, when you can't hold more than one truth in your head, that's the reaction that happens the few days after. I also should say that I think they didn't, among them were people who did not believe the stories that were coming out. It took a while, right? People were, you know, just yesterday, the world press was let into an area and witnessed very, very horrific images and were able to tell the story in a more detailed way, you know, in their own voices, not getting it from Israeli, you know, spokespeople, but actually seeing it with their eyes and telling the world. And I think at least some of those people who you know, have sincere support for Palestinians and for the Palestinian cause, I think some of those people may be revising. We're already seeing it. And so, like, we have to be careful both about what happens in the first hours after something, because people, there's a lot of fog of war. We also have to be, and I would say this now, you know, from the past few days, very much going forward, social media will become, is becoming a major sort of battlefield for consciousness. And, you know, we're seeing, for example, a picture of babies in a chicken coop, which was some very odd picture that predated this. And so, you know, even from our side, why would we think that wasn't true? Or why, you know, people are traumatized, so they're seeing a picture and they don't question it. So unfortunately, we have to say, question everything, you know, that you get on, particularly on social media.
We are speaking with Miriam Herzleib, opinion and blog editor for the Times of Israel, what is, after all, a very difficult and hard topic to discuss, and I appreciate her ability to do that with us. We're going to take another one last station break, and this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we'll be right back with our wrap-up and a final question or two.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, as we are every Friday morning at 9 o'clock. Today we're speaking with Miriam Herzleib of Times of Israel, opinion and blog editor. We are obviously talking about the events and circumstances in Israel, but we're also trying to get a sense of what the events have meant to Israelis rather than the specifics of what happened. I mean, you all have been reading and watching, so you're brought into the news. But it's important to find out what's taking place in the headspace of people who are there. One last question for you, and then let you, you know, offer any summing up ideas. Up until Friday afternoon, basically, there was an expectation that somehow, in some magical way, in effect, the Israelis and the Saudis would begin to come to an official kind of an alliance agreement, maybe not an alliance, but certainly a recognition and a cooperative partnership on many things, midwifed by, marriage brokered by the Americans. And that seems to have evaporated in the wake of what has happened and what may well come. Do Israelis now see that as a failed project? We're going to have to do what we have to do regardless of what it means. Or is there some other way to look at this? I'm not phrasing that really well, but I think you know what I meant.
It's early days, and if you want to ask what Israelis are thinking about, the Saudi-Israel normalization possibility is not on our 10 top, you know, the average Israeli is really not really thinking about it. It's my guess. But the Saudis quickly came out in support of the Palestinians and signaled that they were backing out. Interestingly, their neighbor, the United Arab Emirates, came out supporting words of support for Israel. You know, a Saudi-Israeli normalization is a hugely potentially important strategic move for Israel and for the region. And remember that it's a three-way relationship, where the U.S. is the third, probably the longest leg of that stool. And the U.S. has very much stepped in, you know, given the potential for Iranian involvement, sending us a U.S. aircraft carrier, Gerald Ford, into the region to signal that this, you know, should not devolve into a wider conflict. And in a wider conflict, Saudi Arabia is part of the mosaic, and we would need to essentially be on the same side as they are in a conflict against Iran. So we wouldn't want this possibility to go off the table, but for sure it will be delayed significantly. I want to say, since I've mentioned, you know, the U.S. role in the wider thing. President Biden's speech the other night about his support for Israel was hugely important on an emotional level. He, frankly, unlike our own leaders, managed to find a tone that even the many Israelis who are not sympathetic or supportive of Biden found beautiful, comforting. For him to have said that that Hamas is equivalent or worse, equivalent to ISIS or worse, to hear that from the American president, this clear moral position, this horror that he expressed that felt very genuine over what had happened. This was incredibly important for frankly, for me personally, and I know for many other Israelis.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of Joe Biden, when he finds that vein of every man speaking plainly as every man, he knows how to do that. He knows how to deliver it, and he knows how to it's almost as if there was a slight quiver in his voice when he said it, because he wasn't sure he was going to be able to get to the end of it. I watched it.
Well, he brings his personal tragedy to tragedy, and he's done that many times, and you know, it's a way of him, you know, conveying empathy, and it's important. But don't forget, Biden is probably the, you know, one of the last great, genuine lovers of Israel. He has, you know, made clear genuine sympathy for Israel. He loves to tell the story of his meeting with Golda Meir, in which she said that Israel's secret weapon is that we have nowhere else to go. It's a bit of a trope at this point. He kind of trots it out at every meeting, but there's a reason. It shaped how he considers, you know, Israel. And I think the younger members of the Democratic Party may support Israel because it's politically correct, you know, good for them, or because it's strategically good for the U.S. But Joe Biden really, you know, puts his heart into it.
When he was first elected, I had a conversation with a rabbi from his home district, state of Delaware, in which he and Biden had interacted over the years when Biden was a senator, and Biden would fairly regularly show up in his synagogue or in an apartment building inhabited by many of the people who were members of that congregation. And he got to see that side of him separate from being a politician. And it was good to hear that firsthand view of someone who didn't actually have anything to gain from it. We can only hope that those words carry forward. And I will leave for another time the discussion about further aid to Israel and further aid to Ukraine and the way in which all that's going to transpire in the current Congress in the United States, in the shambles that is taking place there. That's a conversation for a different time. Wrong word for today. It hasn't been a pleasure. It has been important to have a chance to talk with you. And I hope we can do this again in several months' time when things look better and things are less painful.
Thank you so much for having me. And I just want to say, for those who feel connected to Israel, who are sending friends here their messages of support, they are very, very welcome. And we it means a lot to, I know, to friends of mine, to me. I'm getting a lot of beautiful messages. Thanks. And thank everyone for their interest in what happens here.
We have been speaking with Miriam Hirschlag. She's the opinion and blog editor for the Times of Israel. And she has instructed me to read it every day, which I will try to work into my daily news diet now, as opposed to on occasion. Miriam, again, thank you very much. And we look forward to another chat.
Take care.
This is Brooke Spector with the Deep Dive, and we'll be back again next week.